Well, good evening. Take your Bibles, please. Turn them to John 11. Jeff asked me what I was going to teach on. I told him John 11. He said, what verses? All of them. So I told someone earlier we can read this and pray and go home. John chapter 11, starting in verse 1. Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So the sister sent word to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. But when Jesus heard this, he said, this sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he then stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him. This he said, and after that he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go so that I may awaken him out of sleep. The disciples then said to him, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he was speaking of literal sleep. So Jesus then said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him. Therefore Thomas, who was called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go, so that we may die with him. So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Martha, therefore, when she heard that Jesus was coming, went to meet him, but Mary stayed at the house. Martha then said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even the one who comes into the world. When she had said this, she went away and called Mary her sister, saying secretly, the teacher is here and he's calling for you. And when she heard it, she got up quickly and was coming to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha met him. Then the Jews who were with her in the house and consoling her, when they saw that Mary got up quickly and went out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Therefore, when Mary came where Jesus was, she saw him and fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus, therefore, saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled, and said, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. So the Jews were saying, see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man also from dying? So Jesus again, being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now it was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, remove the stone. Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, Lord, by this time there'll be a stench, for he's been dead for 4 days. Jesus said to her, did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? So they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it, so that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. The man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Martha, or came to Mary, and saw what he had done, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people, and that the whole nation not perish." Now he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. Therefore, Jesus no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews, but went away from there to the country near the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim. And there he stayed with the disciples. Now the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went up to Jerusalem out of the country before the Passover to purify themselves. So they were seeking for Jesus and were saying to one another as they stood in the temple, "What do you think, that he will not come to the feast at all?" Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he was to report it so that they might seize him. Okay, we have a very familiar story here. And there's a lot of things that can be learned from it. You've probably studied it yourself. You've probably heard a lot of sermons preached. A lot of different ways you can go with it. I warned somebody that we're going through all this, but not very deep, which would be a long, long time if we went very deep in a lot of the things. So if I can avoid all the bunny trails, we'll try to get through the whole passage. But I want to look at one thing in particular, because sometimes when we see these stories that are so familiar with to us, we kind of take them out of context, and not to any bad motive or anything else, but I think we miss the bigger picture. And I'm kind of a big picture guy, and I like to see how things fit in with the plan. Now, if you'll turn to John chapter 20, this is kind of John's mission statement. This is the purpose. In fact, he says that. This is towards the end of his gospel, but it's dealing with all these things. John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. "Therefore, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." Now, one of the things that is noted by a lot of people, if you go through and you look at them, there are seven public miracles that Jesus performs. And books have been written on why he did them in that order and what each of them signified. That may be helpful and maybe not. I don't know. But the one we're looking at tonight is the last of those seven. And it is by far the most spectacular one that he did. The others are, he turned water into wine, he healed a nomad's son, healed at the pool, fed 5,000, walked on water, and healed a man born blind. We've seen those all. And of course, there are many more in the other gospels. And that is why John says what he said. Listen, if I try to write all these down, there's not enough books in all the world, because Jesus did a lot of fantastic things. I think we kind of glibly hear him say that and don't think that through. You're talking about thousands probably of miracles over and over and over and touching all these different people. Now, one of the things I decided I'd do tonight, there must be a virus or something in the teaching around here, I decided I would alliterate. Imagine where I got that. But I'm going to give it a go. Hang on. Problem, promise, perplexity, prayer, power, purpose, politics, prophecy, perfidy, Passover, plan. Now that happens to be a personal best for me. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a record for Indian Hills. Possibly the whole town. Who knows? It was interesting, though. Some of those you got to kind of work at, but we'll make them fit. Sometimes you have to put a silent letter ahead of it and just pronounce the P too. Well, let's start looking at the passage a little bit. You know, we don't want to look for doctrine, particularly in the history books, the Gospels and Acts. But we find doctrinal things. We find things that help us understand when we learn about the doctrines later. And we see a lot of that here. But the main thing I want to look at here is the deity and the humanity of Christ. And there's no better place to look to see both of them in action than in this miracle. So, first four verses. "Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So the sister sent word to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. But when Jesus heard this, he said, this sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Now, one of the things that is kind of a mystery when you really look at it is, who are these people? Mary and Martha and Lazarus, we hear about them all the time. Turn over to Luke chapter 10. We find out from this, and we'll find out a little more about them personally, but in this passage, we find out that they are very close friends of Jesus. He loves them dearly, and I'm sure they return that. But as far as I know, the only other place we see anything about them is Luke chapter 10, verses 38 through 42. And we can infer some things because of this. Now, as they were traveling along, he entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. She had a sister called Mary who was seated at the Lord's feet listening to his word. But Martha was distracted with all her preparations, and she came up to him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? Then tell her to help me. But the Lord answered and said to her, Martha, Martha, you are worried and bothered about so many things, but only one thing is necessary, for Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her. Now, it's interesting because the things that we know about Mary and Martha is that Martha is kind of a fuss budget, you know, and Mary kind of, she's kind of the hero one of the story because she sits and listens to Jesus. I was listening to one guy, he said that Mary and Martha, if you got them Christmas presents, you'd get Mary Spurgeon's commentaries and you get Martha a router. So there's a distinct difference. But we don't really find out much more about them. Obviously, they were well-to-do. Obviously, they were prominent people. We're going to find out later they had a lot of friends, and it can be assumed, I believe, that they helped Jesus in his ministry, at least helped him on his way, had a meal with him, and so forth. Now, they are appealing to the love that he has for Lazarus for him to come, and it's obvious what they want. They want him to come and heal Lazarus, so they know a lot about Jesus and his abilities. Now, first, we've got another P we've got to look at, Perea. That's extra, but there's a reason we need to look at it, because they went to get Jesus. Well, where was he and why? Because it makes a big difference when we understand that. Some of the other things make more sense. So Perea is just across the Jordan River. I think it would be modern-day Jordan, if I remember right. But look in chapter 10 of John. We don't have to go far, really, to find out what's going on. And let's look just at the last three verses, 40 through 42, to get an idea of what's going on over there. And he went away again beyond the Jordan to the place where John was first baptizing, and he was staying there. Many came to him and were saying, while John performed no sign, yet everything John said about this man was true. Many believed in him there. We read that and we tend to think, well, it's obvious Jesus is going about doing his ministry, going about preaching the gospel of the kingdom, probably healing people, doing wonders, proving who he is, declaring that he is the Messiah. But that really wasn't the reason he went there. Now, he did that, but if we back up a little further into chapter 10 to verse 31, and I know this is carrying a lot further than that chapter, but it's very important to set the stage. Verse 31 of chapter 10. The Jews picked up stones again to stone him. Jesus answered them, I showed you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you stoning me? The Jews answered him, for good work we do not stone you, but for blasphemy, and because you, being a man, make yourself out to be God. Jesus answered them, has it not been written in your law, I said you were gods? If he called them gods to whom the word of God came, and the scripture cannot be broken, do you say of him whom the Father sanctified and sent into the world, you are blaspheming because I said I am the Son of God? If I do not do the works of my Father, do not believe me. But if I do them, though you do not believe me, believe the works, so that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father. So this is the background, and this is a famous passage. The Jews are ready to kill Jesus because he has claimed equality with God. It's interesting that the Jews didn't have any problem understanding that he's claiming to be a deity, but a lot of people through the ages have had a problem with that. The Jews fully understood it, and they're ready to stone him because stoning is what you do to blasphemers. So they're calling him a blasphemer, And worse than that. Okay, so what's that got to do with anything? He's over in Perea, and there's a reason. And here's one of the other P's. I'm not even going to keep track of those. They're dazzling you with them. But politics. First, we have the problem, and then we'll have an explanation of it. Prior to this time, the Romans had allowed the kings of this area to remain kings for the most part. What they would do is they'd go into a country and add it to the empire. And as long as they could make it work, they'd keep hereditary leaders or whoever happened to be on the throne, as long as they could work with them, because it made things go smoother. And remember, if you are a king underneath the Romans or a prefect or whatever you are, you really have two jobs. And that's really all they're concerned about. Keep the peace, send the taxes. That's all they really care about. And as long as you do those, you get away with quite a bit of stuff. And they have their own troops and everything. Now, at the time of this story, we have, of course, Pontius Pilate. He's the Roman prefect. Well, how did he get there? Because if you remember back to the birth of Christ, the king was Herod. So how do we go from King Herod to a Roman prefect? Glad you asked. You know that's what I'm going to tell you about, whether you want it or not. The Romans, again, would allow these kings to hold their positions, but they had to go to Rome and basically get interviewed and have Rome's blessing so they could go off. And when they did that, they would also give them troops so that they had their own little army or militia to back up whatever it is that they needed to do for Rome and to collect the taxes. Now, if you remember, there was a statement made when Herod died. Remember, Joseph and Mary fled to Egypt. They were coming back, and they heard that Archelaus was reigning in his father's place. Okay, so what happened? Herod had died. He actually left a will, and in that will, he specified his three sons, Herod Antipas, Archelaus, and Philip, to divide the kingdom up. So they have to go to Rome and get the okay on this. Well, when it was all said and done, they allowed Archelaus to be called an ethnarch. Not, it sounds like some kind of a drug thing. Ethnarch. And he would be a ruler over a group of people. His brother was called a tetrarch, which is a little bit lower. And I think Philip, his other brother, was also called a tetrarch. Anyway, Archelaus ends up ruling over Judea and Samaria. And Herod Antipas, the other son, has Perea and Galilee, which those two are all we're concerned about. The others are harder to pronounce than that. And Philip doesn't come into the equation at all. But here at this time, we have had Archelaus ruling Samaria and Judea. But he was not a good ruler. I don't know if you're aware of Herod's background. Herod the Great, not Herod the Good, but Herod the Great, he was actually the son of an Idumean and a Nabataean Arabian. So his father was a descendant of Esau, and his mother was a descendant of Ishmael. And he was the king of the Jews. And by the way, he had a Greek name. So he had a lot going for him, but none of it had to do with being Jewish. So he kind of gave lip service to being Jewish. Now this son, Archelaus, that he had left this portion to, was kind of even worse than that. He had his father, and then his mother was a Samaritan. And we all know how the warm feelings that the Jews and the Samaritans had. So it's almost like you just can't get any worse for a ruler of the Jews than to have Archelaus. And he proved that out. He couldn't get along with the Jews. The Jews had enough. They went so far as to send delegations to Rome to complain about how bad he was. And Rome listened to him, and they sent him into exile into Vienna. All that to say that they decided that Judea and Samaria now are just going to be under a prefect. So they bring in one of their Roman governors and place him in power, and they give him all this authority, and he's actually got it better than the others. Now, by the time we get to Pontius Pilate, there have been five other prefects. But Pontius Pilate now is the prefect in Judea. That's where we're concerned about. The king is still Herod Antipas over in Perea. Now, there's a reason I tell you all this. The Jews are a hard bunch of people to rule. I don't know if you ever picked up on that through history, but they don't like to bow the knee. Pontius Pilate came in. He was a big blustering bully when he came in, and he was going to impose his will. He didn't find out what the Jews were like. He didn't find out much about their customs. He tried putting up statues in the temple, things like that, and ended up spilling a lot of blood. Well, all this gets reported back to Rome. Now, the reason he got his position in the first place was because of a man named Sejanus. Don't you love all this history? I know you do. Sejanus was the head of the Praetorian Guards who guarded Caesar. Well, he was pretty high up on the ladder, and so he took Pontius Pilate under his wing. He got him this job, and this job is a great job because you get to tax all of the merchandise that comes through that area, and everything has to come through there that wants to go south or north. So you get rich, and you just skim a little off. The Romans, as long as they got their part, they didn't care what you taxed everybody. So you make sure you get plenty. Pilate couldn't do that anymore. He was in big trouble because Sejanus, his patron, was caught in a plot to assassinate the emperor. That doesn't go over very well. So they invited Sejanus to the Senate, where they killed him. And when they did that, they would purge everybody that had anything to do with the traitor, the plotter. That would have included Pontius Pilate. He was one of his little minions. But they let it go. Tiberius, the ruler at that time, let it go, and he kind of kept his eye on it, and Pilate just kept doing the wrong thing. So by the time we're here, this is why the Jews could get Pilate to do all the things they got him to do later. He would have never crucified Christ if he didn't have this very, very shaky rule here. Now, Antipas across the river in Perea, no problems at all. In fact, there weren't nearly as many Jews over there. There were a lot of Gentiles over there. And he didn't know Rome anything. He didn't know the Jews anything. He didn't have to do anything they said. All of this to say, this is why Jesus is in Perea, because he leaves the jurisdiction of the Roman that the Jews can force to do things, and he goes across into the realm of Antipas. Antipas, about the only thing we know with him in connection with Jesus is Jesus called him a fox. He said, "You tell that fox." And that was a gimmick. The Pharisees were trying to get him to go back to Judea, and they said, "Herod's trying to kill you." And he's like, "Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm not falling for that." So he's across the river in Perea, about where John the Baptist had baptized. So he's safe over there. Now, he didn't run because he was afraid. Jesus feared no man. He feared nothing. In fact, the only thing he did, he dreaded the act of taking our sins and the Father's wrath, but that's all. So he's not there because he is scared. And this is the part that is very interesting to me. When Jesus is making these moves, he is thinking well ahead. You know, we often think this stuff, we kind of get it in a vacuum and never really think it through as it's happening in history. But Jesus planned all this out. So he knows what he's doing, and he's avoiding issues. But the other thing he's going to do now with this situation with Lazarus, he is going to push them into doing what they want to do anyway. Okay, now we're back to Perea. He's heard the message from Mary and Martha. By the way, one of the things that's interesting, you hear Mary talk, you hear Martha talk, Lazarus, he doesn't get any of his words recorded. I don't know. I suppose those two sisters kept him quiet. But just an interesting little fact that you can think about. Okay, now he made sure, Jesus did here in verse 4. He said, "This sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it." So he fully understands what is going on with Lazarus, and the messenger has found him. He tells the messengers and his disciples that he's not going to die. This illness is not to bring about his death, but it's going to be used to glorify the Lord and God the Son. So he made sure that everybody heard this. Okay, let's look in verse 5 now. "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard he was sick, he then stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was." So rather than go back with the messenger or head back as soon as possible, he waits around. And he makes sure that he waits for 2 days. Now, in verse 7, then after this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. So he's waited around these 2 days. As far as the disciples are concerned, Lazarus must be well because here we are still here. He said it wasn't going to end in death. So they're kind of wondering, well, what's going on? In verse 8, they make it real clear. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you. And are you going there again? It's a legitimate question. What is going on? You had us come over here to get away from the murderous Jews, and now you're going to go back? And the next two verses, people wonder about what they mean. Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks in a day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. I think all he's saying is there, listen, guys, I know what I'm doing. I'm not out here stumbling around in the dark. I'm doing the Father's will, and I'm doing it in the daylight. It's not a problem. But you can imagine, they are still not very eager to go back there. Well, look in verse 11. This he said, and after that he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go so that I may awaken him out of sleep. The disciples then said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover. Are you picking up on the fact that the disciples really don't get what's going on here? Not for the first time. Verse 13, so he finally, now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he was speaking of literal sleep. So Jesus said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. Now, if you're one of the disciples, you're sitting there thinking, what is going on? He just got through saying that this was not going to lead to death. Now he tells us he is dead. What is the deal? Maybe they weren't thinking that, but I think they would. But he even states why. He says, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him. So he's doing this for their benefit. He's even telling them he's doing it for their benefit so that you will believe. Now, this next line, if you don't understand the background, this is a terribly gloomy non sequitur. It's just like, where did that come from? Therefore, Thomas, who is called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go so that we may die with him. See, if you don't understand the backstory, that is a real head scratcher. What are you talking about, Thomas? Gloomy Thomas? Doubting Thomas? No, actually, pretty brave Thomas, at least on the face of it. He's ready to go back because as far as he knows, they're going back to the same group that wanted to stone Jesus. And they haven't cooled down. They are still angry and upset, and the disciples know that. So they go with him, and off they go. Verse 17, so when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. I want to see where I'm at on my P's here. Doesn't matter. Promise is the next one for whatever that's worth. So now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Okay, the Jewish mourning, the mourning period lasts about a week, the initial mourning period. And the way it usually works is very soon after someone died, they would prepare them, they would wash their body. A lot of times just in the clothes they're at, they make it into strips and wrap them, put ointment or various sweet-smelling herbs and so forth, and put them in the tomb as soon as possible. Now, when we get here, he is showing up like, well, what's going on here? And these people have been there all this time. That's what it's talking about in verse 19. Many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So you got a crowd of people here. Now, do you think Jesus knows this? Yes, he does very well. And he's not exercising his deity. He's using his wisdom in his humanity. He knows how this works. And so he is waited. Now, it says Bethany's just 2 miles off from Jerusalem. I think the reason it tells us that is to let us know there are a lot of people from Jerusalem who are there with Mary and Martha, consoling them. And it seems that the family is well known. Verse 20, Martha, therefore, when she heard that Jesus was coming, went to meet him, but Mary stayed at the house. Sounds just like him, doesn't it? Martha's always busy. Mary's sitting around studying. Martha then said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. There's the promise. another P. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. I want him now is what the idea is. Now, we don't really get any indication that Martha is expecting him to raise Lazarus. She just wonders why he wasn't there. Some people think she was being a little upset and a little naggy. I don't think so. I just think she was very sad and really wondered what was going on. Now, listen to what Jesus says. Verse 24, she says, I know he's going to rise again on the last day. But Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? You hear that quoted at funerals all the time. Now, the interesting thing, she has already said in verse 22, even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. So she's expecting something from Jesus, but I don't think it's this. But her answer to this is great. It's one of the best answers in the whole New Testament. She said to him, yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world. Now, we see some perplexity next. She believes this, and now she is going to, well, verse 28. When she had said this, she went away and called Mary, her sister, saying secretly. Now, she's just telling this to Mary. The teacher is here, and he's calling for you. Jesus has come. He wants to talk to you. When she heard it, she got up quickly and was coming to him. Now, Jesus had not yet come into the village, so he's still outside of town, but was still in the place where Martha met him. Then the Jews who were with her in the house and consoling her, when they saw Mary, got up quickly and went out. They followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. So a kind of a typical situation. These people are there to help them grieve and mourn. And so Mary gets up. They assume she's going back to the tomb, which was a typical thing for them to do, was go to the tomb or the place where people were buried to mourn and weep. Some of it was kind of a ritual. You know, you could hire people to do that, which doesn't seem very genuine. But by now, there is getting to be a lot of people around. We look further on. Now, Jesus had not yet come. Okay, verse 31. Then the Jews were with her in the house and consoling her. When they saw that Mary got up quickly and went out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Therefore, when Mary came where Jesus was, she saw him and fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. You get the feeling that Mary and Martha may have been talking about this some. They have this exact same response to Jesus. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled. Now, we don't get the full understanding of that in English very well. He was, you know, like bitterly sad. He was agonized and angry over this. And the whole thing was because of death. He was angry at the fact that it separated people, angry seeing these people all mourning and weeping. He's acting just like you or I would, compassionately. Well, I hope we would. Anyway, verse 34, and he said, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. The favorite verse of all those who memorize verses, right? Shortest. But again, this weeping here is now simply weeping out of sadness because he has feelings for Lazarus. He understands what it is to be separated. He gets what the sisters are feeling. And the Jews see this, the mourners. So the Jews were saying, see how he loved him. Now, here's the perplexity. But some of them said, could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man also from dying? Seems like a legitimate question. What was the deal? And you can imagine the disciples are thinking, yeah, we wonder that too, because we were with him over there and we waited around and then we come back and we could have been here earlier. Now, here's the thing that really perplexes him. Verse 38. So Jesus, again, being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. And again, this is that deep anger and sadness. Now, it was a cave and a stone was lying against it. Now, they're beginning to wonder by this time what is going on here. It's going to become very apparent to her. Jesus said, remove the stone. Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he's been dead for 4 days. Okay, if you think about that, he's been dead 4 days, so he must have died after the messenger left to get Jesus. Now, Jesus understands that, and he makes sure 4 days. Everyone knows this. He's been there 4 days. These people that were with them have helped her, probably helped carry Lazarus' body, probably helped anoint him, helped get him ready for burial. They put him in there. They felt his cold, dead body. They understand, yeah, he's been dead for 4 days, and we know what happens. After 4 days, the body starts to decompose. It was true then, as it's true now. A hotter climate, it would even be worse. This is part of the reason they hurry up and get him buried. So this is a horrible breach of etiquette, to say the least. But Jesus is going to show them, in verse 40, Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" It's that perplexity. Now, this is too much for her. You've probably all heard this, the fact that according to Jewish folklore that the spirit would hang around for 3 days, and that was part of this. Well, I actually looked it up, and yeah, it says that. It says, although the soul protests its birth into the world, it also protests the body's death. It lingers near the body for 3 days, hoping that it will return to life. And that's from Tanhuma, Miketz 4 and Pekudai 3. Yeah. Another one, after 3 days, the soul returns to God to await the time of resurrection. That's from the Babylonian Talmud. You probably heard of that. That's where people get that notion that the Jews believed that. Now, how many of these believed that or thought that was true really is beside the point, because this has nothing to do with folklore. This is physiology, biology. This is real life. Now, we know that Jesus waited, and he made sure that they knew this was going to be for the glory of God. We're starting to see what he's talking about. In fact, we already know. But remember, one of the most audacious requests in the Old Testament was given by Moses. In Exodus 33, verses 18 to 20, you can turn there if you want, but I'm just going to go ahead and start right in. Then Moses said, "I pray you, show me your glory." And he said, "I myself will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim the name of the Lord before you, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show compassion on whom I will show compassion." But he said, "You cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live." One of the things about glory, especially in an Old Testament context, it is displayed. That's how people know the glory of God. That's what Jesus is talking about here. But part of that glory is his loving kindness, his compassion. So you're going to get that. That is why Jesus is going to do what he's going to do. But it's also going to be glorious in any other way you can think of. Now we got another P here, verses 41, 42, prayer. So they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it, so that they may believe that you sent me." So he's talking out loud. Have you ever done one of those? You're praying with somebody you know is not a believer, so you pray the gospel. It's a good thing to do, actually. It's kind of what he's doing here. "Lord, these people, they don't get it. I already know that you hear me. I'm saying this for their benefit. And I thank you, and this needs to be done so that they will believe that you sent me." So, verse 41, so they removed the stone, okay? They pull that stone away, and Martha was right. The stench was horrible. I think that's a part of the whole idea. This is why Jesus waited that long, made sure that Lazarus was dead, made sure that there would be no denying he's dead. If they had any doubts before, they are now completely believing it. He is gone. They knew it anyway. Then he prays the prayer. You can just imagine what these people are thinking. This is just terrible. Why are you doing this to this family? You know, you got this guy, he's dead, and he's starting to stink, and you have us roll this stone away? 43, when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." Now, I've heard a lot of, probably every sermon you hear on this, somebody says, if he wouldn't have said Lazarus, all the dead people would have raised up. I think he's got better control than that myself. But it makes a good point. He is specifying, there's no doubt, this dead man that is very, very dead, you, Lazarus, come forth. Now, where it says he said it in a loud voice, I think the Greek is something like loudly he said aloud, something like that. Really intense. It's not quite a yell, but he's speaking in a very authoritative voice so that nobody misses it. Lazarus, come forth. And I don't know if you've ever seen movies or anything that tries to depict this. Usually there's that dramatic pause, you know, and everybody's watching the tomb, and pretty quick he comes kind of creeping out. I don't think it was anything like that. If you woke up in a tomb, wouldn't you want to get out of there? You know, I don't think there was any hesitation. I think immediately he comes forth. The only thing I really wonder about, he's bound hand and foot. You know, is he hopping? Sorry, maybe you'll have that image in your mind. But I always wonder that. How do you get out? You know, he tells him, you know, get that cloth off of the face. We don't want him to suffocate and I have to do this again. So let him go. Now, you can imagine why he has to tell them that. They're stunned. They're absolutely stunned that, you know, we know something is going on here. We're not sure who this guy is. They say he's got power. But really, what's going on? And now this. And the interesting thing is now the reaction. Now, wouldn't you think that everybody would line up with a counselor to hear the gospel and believe after this? Well, some did. Verse 45. This, by the way, we just went through power, and now we're at purpose, okay? Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. Now, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? You saw somebody raise somebody from the dead, and he claims that he's the Messiah. Sounds right. He sure proved it, because that's one of the things that the signs are to do, are to authenticate the messenger of God, in this case, God himself. But look in verse 46. This is really sad. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. You know, the way that's worded, it's almost like, we're going to tell on you. You know, you're in trouble now. And I think that's what they had in mind. But the purpose that Jesus had was this: to show these people who he was, really show them who he was, and to accomplish exactly the other side of that in verse 46. He knows there are going to be spies there. He knows that they're after him. He has a price on his head. He's a wanted man in Judea. And it's a wonder they didn't, well, maybe it isn't a wonder that they didn't try to capture him. If you can raise people from the dead, you probably keep your hands off of them. So they go and tell the leaders. Now, they came from the Pharisees. Now, one of the other things you need to understand, we know that the relationship between Jesus and the Pharisees is a little tense, right? And it's mainly because the Pharisees control all of these synagogues. They are the ones, the Pharisees and the lawyers, and they're buddies all the time. But they're the ones who keep track of what's going on in the synagogues. That's why if you get in trouble with them, they kick you out of the synagogue. If you get kicked out of the synagogue, you can't buy, sell. There's nothing you can do. So they have their thumb on that. Now, they are also the ones who are lovers of money. They are always, always, always asking Jesus for a sign. Matthew 12:38. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees said to him, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." Now, here's one that's really amazing. Luke 11:14-16, and he was casting out a demon, and it was mute. When the demon had gone out, the mute man spoke, and the crowds were amazed. But some of them said, "He casts out demons by Beelzebul, the ruler of the demons." Others, to test him, were demanding of him a sign from heaven. You just saw him cast out a demon. That's not enough. Well, of course, their view of it was, and they hold that to this day, any of them that you can pin down, that Jesus worked his miracles by the power of Satan, that he was possessed. But now he has shown in an undeniable way, with positive results again, he can raise the dead. By the way, you hear these wolves on TV who talk about, you know, they quote the verse, you know, says we'll do greater things than Jesus, and that's what we're up to. All right, let's see you head to the morgue. You know, let's see you perform. See if you can top this. You can't. I won't get off on that. Okay. Now we have them asking for signs, which shows Look in verse 48. It's not like they are disbelieving what they've seen. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him. Well, yeah, that's kind of the point. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Let me give you a little clue here. The Romans have already taken over their nation, and they're only in their place because the Romans allow them. Yeah, the Romans picked the high priest, so they were in control of everything there. But it's concerning to them because they think this is going to go on. The Romans are going to look at it as a challenge, and then they'll really come down hard on us. The Pharisees are probably worried because they're going to want more taxes, because that was their big deal, was money. But now, on to the next P, prophecy. 49, but one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people and that the whole nation not perish." Now, he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who were scattered abroad. There, you know, it makes you wonder if Caiaphas asked himself what he just said, because he actually hits the nail on the head. But John says he did this because he was high priest. Even though he's an illegitimate high priest, God uses him to get this truth out there. Verse 53, perfidy. Don't you like that word, perfidy? I had to stretch the definition a little bit, but it'll work. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. Now, this is the one that always amazes me when you see it in stark letters like that. These guys were rotten people. They're murderous. They are full of hate. They're full of envy. They're full of all kinds of rotten sins. But they're willing to kill someone because he doesn't go along with their rigid set of corruption as what Judaism had become by then. So they're willing to kill him. The interesting thing is they are getting together. Now, you don't have to know too much about the New Testament to know that the Pharisees and the Sadducees don't get along. The Pharisees controlled the synagogues, and they were actually looked up to by most of the common people because they had this rigid set of extra laws, and they would keep them scrupulously. So the common people thought, if anybody's going to make it, it's going to be these guys. So they kind of looked up to him. Sadducees, they hated him. They controlled the temple. And it's interesting because Josephus called the temple the bazaars of Annas, because this is where the high priest, the Sadducees controlled that. They control the temple, and they make money right and left during the feast seasons. And I won't go into all that, how they would cheat people. But for one thing, you couldn't pay the temple tax with anything but temple money. And they were happy to exchange your money for that money with a little bit extra thrown in. So they're conning people out of stuff. They're forcing them to buy what they want them to buy. And they are rotten to the core. It's interesting because Jesus began his ministry, not the very first thing, but early in his ministry, he cleaned the temple out, ran them out of there, said, "You're not going to make my Father's house into a store." Then he goes two more Passovers. He didn't do it again. But during all that time, he's going around showing the Pharisees up in all the synagogues. And he keeps being confronted by them. He keeps putting them in their place. And they absolutely are frustrated. And they are so frustrated, they are ready to kill. So they plan together to kill him. Now, he does the same thing, verse 54. Therefore, Jesus no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews, but went away from there to a country near the wilderness into a city called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. So they go a little bit, 12 miles north of Jerusalem, and they stay in this little village of Ephraim. Now, it's interesting because actually a lot of Luke falls into place between verse 54 and 55, and I won't take you on that little excursion, but if you harmonize the passages and look at the history, there's a lot that takes place historically between 54 and 55. So there is the Passover, though, in 55, because this is now what this is all building up to. Verse 55, now the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went up to Jerusalem out of the country before the Passover to purify themselves. Now, if you want to see if this had any impact on these people, this is several months later. I'm not sure exactly how much later, but there's a period of time that has passed between the raising of Lazarus and the Passover. The Passover is near, verse 56. So they were seeking for Jesus and were saying to one another as they stood in the temple, "What do you think? That he will not come to the feast at all?" Now the chief priests and the Pharisees have given orders that if anyone knew where he was to report it so that they might seize him. Okay, so now we've got the Passover coming up, and we have actually what we have seen, and this is one of the things to take from this, is you have such a blending of the humanity and the deity of Christ. He weeps, he mourns, he asks them, where have you laid him? And then he raises him from the dead. Who can do that? God. So both of those are seen here very clearly. But one of the things that's interesting, Jesus as a man, perfect man, unfallen mind, very wise, he has set this up because he is now forcing the hands of the Jewish leaders. He knows that they're not going to be able to stone him. He knows what is coming, and he realizes that there are certain things that he can do and does do to set that up. And this is one of them. He makes sure that the resurrection of Lazarus is well known. He does it in such a way that it is greater than any others. You know, he raised the widow of Nain's son, and he raised Jairus's daughter, and there were crowds of people, and they were in wonder. Those happened shortly after they died. This one, he made sure that everybody knew, and there is no way that you can say that this wasn't a valid, I guess we should say, resuscitation, because he is going to die later again. But it's this brilliance on Jesus' part as he works this through that is important to understand in this, along with the other context of it. But look in chapter 12, verses 9 through 11, because this will tell you exactly how this goes. By the way, Jesus set it up, so they're in Ephraim. He's getting ready to go to the Passover. What he does, instead of going south to Jerusalem, he goes north into Galilee, and he's lived there most of his life. He joins some of those bands of pilgrims coming down, and he performs a lot of his miracles. So by the time he gets to Bethany, which is where he ends up staying again, there's this massive mob of people who have been with him and have seen him heal, seen him do all these other things. And what's on their mind? It said, you know, they're wondering, is he going to come? Well, look here in verse 9 of chapter 12. The large crowd of Jews then learned that he was there. And they came, not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he raised from the dead. But the chief priests planned to put Lazarus to death also, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and were believing in Jesus. So it's interesting as you look at this, there's so much you can draw from it. But I think it's important to understand how it is that Jesus accomplished all these things. He didn't do it simply because he's God in the flesh. He did it as an unfallen man who understood what it took to play these people off each other. It's brilliant as you go through, and there's more passages in this that help us see that. But this is the grand finale. This is the act that has finally pushed these people together. So the question now, since we've gone through all that, we didn't do what people normally do as you look there, but here's the Lord of life. He calls himself. It was interesting to me that Jesse talked about some of these things this morning. He is life. He said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." He proved that. But now the question is, have you got that life? Not the physical life, but the spiritual life. We're all born dead spiritually. It's very important. Here you understand, looking at the compassion of Jesus, the second thing we can see here is, if you are his child and you're dealing with tough issues in your life, are you seeking his power or his purpose? Mostly we want his power. We never think about his purpose. Now, he's a compassionate God, and he hasn't changed just because of your circumstances. You know, everybody's going through something. But are you looking to him to relieve you? Are you looking to him to do what you want? Or are you trying to find out what he's trying to do through you? Because that's a definite lesson we learned from how he worked in Lazarus's life, Mary and Martha, the disciples, and he did exactly what he said. He glorified the Son, he glorified the Father, and he helped their faith to increase because of who he is. And third, are you sharing the Lord of life with the spiritually dead that you encounter? You know, we look at this and we realize death comes to everyone. I was going to quote that Scottish philosopher, Mark Knopfler, every man has to die. He's not a philosopher, he's a guitarist. But that's too subtle, so I didn't do it. But he makes a valid point. Everybody has an appointment with death. Lazarus happened to have two appointments with death, and a few others through the ages have. But everyone you meet has an appointment with physical death. They're already dead spiritually. That's been the challenge that Jesse's put before us, to reach those people, to share this life with them, to share the life, Jesus Christ. Let's pray. Father, we thank you that you give us all these illustrations all the way through your word. You help us to understand and see how you've acted. Some are more clear than others. And in this, we see how Jesus used the politics of the day, used the geography, used all of these things to his advantage to accomplish your will. And he knew that it was heading to the cross for him. But he kept on. He endured the cross. And Father, I pray for any who are here tonight who may not know you, who may never have bowed the knee to you, who don't believe in the Lord of life, that you'll do a work in their hearts tonight and draw them to you. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.